Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Good morning and welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Michael Wilbur and Tom Shand. Our monthly topics today are going to be, I think, very timely based on some recent events that have occurred in a major East Coast fire department, and we're going to be focusing today a lot on apparatus maintenance and some of the issues relative to taking what you have behind your bay doors and maintaining it properly. So our rundown today, we're going to start out, as always, with Brother Mike leading us through a couple of the recent accidents and incidents, what's been going on across the country. We're then going to talk in detail over the recently released Mercury Associates report on the Boston Fire Department and their maintenance program. We're then going to try to hammer home some of the salient issues that were raised out of that report, and going to want to bring that inward to our own departments. And let's look at what we're doing behind closed doors in many cases. And then if we have time allowing, we'll respond back to a few questions from our listeners. So kicking off, Brother Mike here, we're taping this in the middle of March. Weather's starting to get a little bit better, at least in certain parts of the country. Some of the snow melting. Maybe we can potentially, at least in some departments, think of maybe hanging up those snow ice chains for the rest of the year until fall. But sounds like from some of the discussions we had off air, we're still not doing real well with respect to some accidents. So what do you got for us today?
Well, obviously, Tom, like you alluded to, the big news today comes out of a much-anticipated report on the fatal fire truck accident that occurred earlier this year in January in the city of Boston. But before we get to that, certainly no lack of material, unfortunately, and just had a really horrendous past week with apparatus incidents, but probably the first that comes to mind as far as just a real tragedy, and I think, Tom, probably an apparatus operator's worst nightmare come true is the tragic accident that occurred in Kansas City where a seven-year-old child ran out in front of a fire engine and was fatally killed, you know, fatally injured, and ultimately died. And I can't think of any event that could happen behind the wheel of an ambulance or a fire truck that just is the absolute worst. My heart and prayers go out to the family of not only the little boy, but also of the firefighter operator of that vehicle. He joins a very exclusive club that none of us on the drive apparatus want to belong to. And it's interesting when it gets to that point, it really doesn't matter who's to blame. The reality is, and there was no blame, by the way, with the fire department at all whatsoever. It was just a little boy doing what little boys do, unfortunately, that resulted in this tragedy. But the reality is that it doesn't even matter if there was any blame at all. It's just the fact that this little boy has been killed, and a brother firefighter has to live with that for the rest of his life. And because, as you well know, Tom, and everybody out there, that we are in the business of saving lives, and so that when we take a life in the performance of our duty, it's just a psychological burden like no other, and we certainly want to pass our heartfelt prayers to those involved in that just horrific event. Moving on now, again, no loss for headlines. Nine firefighters win a lawsuit on hearing loss against Federal Signal Corporation in the Chicago area. That story came off the wire from the Chicago Tribune on the 23rd of February. In Wyoming, a fire apparatus rollover crash. One firefighter was seriously injured. This happened when their apparatus rolled over while responding. They were involved in a one-vehicle accident at about midnight, and actually the accident itself sparked the brush fire. It rolled, the truck rolled 1.5 times, injuring the firefighters, while two firefighters extricated from the apparatus. More to follow on that. Another real tragedy occurred in Lanier County, Georgia. A firefighting family was deeply affected as a wreck involving a fire apparatus killed and injured his brother, both in the line of duty. The one firefighter was riding in the officer's seat. He died when the truck overturned, and his brother was driving the apparatus and was seriously injured as they were going to this what was determined to be a farm at a fire. It was an unknown caller that reported an out-of-control fire. That was simply not the case. Just another real tragedy with two brothers involved in that wreck. A Shreveport fire chief was critically injured after that chief fell off of an aerial ladder truck that was in a Mardi Gras parade. In West Virginia, a firefighter was in critical condition after a tanker rollover. He was in extreme critical condition with severe head trauma. According to unconfirmed reports, the 2,000-gallon commercial fire tanker went off the road, and the firefighter overcorrected, crossed two lanes of traffic, went through a guardrail, and went down a 70-foot embankment, and later learned that that firefighter was ejected due to the lack of a seatbelt and seriously injured. An SUV hits a fire jeep in Pennsylvania. They were struck while responding to a brush fire. An Exeter firefighter who was driving the jeep and his passenger were taken to a hospital for their injuries after the vehicle overturned from the impact of the SUV. Both men were seatbelted in, and the one firefighter was wearing his helmet at the time of the crash, it was reported. In Long Island, New York, a vehicle responding to an emergency call collided with a car, leaving the car's driver with serious internal injuries. Reports are that the two firefighters were treated for minor injuries after the crash. They said Nassau police were investigating this crash and that there was no criminal conduct at all. The firefighters were responding in a sports utility vehicle when they collided with the car at an intersection. It's not known how fast either vehicle was going or who was at fault. And just this past weekend, a Spring Garden fire truck overturned, trapping three firefighters inside for a short period of time while en route to a structural fire. At 5:30 in the morning, the driver of the vehicle apparently lost control and overturned on a curve. The chief arrived a short time later to help remove his men from the vehicle. The victims were reported to have minor injuries, with one firefighter possibly having glass in his eye from the accident. The home was already fully engulfed in flames prior to firefighters arriving on scene, and according to reports, was considered a total loss. There was no indications as to whether anybody was in the home at the time of the blaze, and there were no injuries reported. And finally, in the state of Iowa, two firefighters and a civilian were injured in a crash involving a pickup truck and a city fire truck north of Pulaski, Iowa. A firefighter was airlifted from the scene, and another was taken to the hospital. A third was transported by POV. They were attempting a turn with the fire apparatus responding when somebody just ran right into the side of them and struck them on the side. The apparatus rotated clockwise and then entered a ditch, rolling several times before coming to rest on its top in the bottom of the ditch.
Well, Mike, it certainly sounds like
the airlift lifted was considered to be in critical condition, and again, our thoughts and prayers go out to that firefighter and his family and to the firefighters involved. Tom, busy apparatus news cycle here. Just roll over after roll over, going too fast, and not really expecting the unexpected. Any thoughts?
Well, Mike, it seems like despite a lot of good things that we appear to be doing in terms of, you know, things that we've talked about in the past of developing specifications to buy safer apparatus, newer apparatus, what we're going to shortly launch into is apparatus that's properly maintained to get people to be seated and belted. There are going to be situations that are unaccounted for where these tragedies are going to happen. If departments and folks that are listening to us could take this message out to the departments that do not do this, of just simply respond in a safe and sane manner, whatever definition you want to attach to that, ensure that your apparatus is properly maintained and that your personnel are properly encased in their protective gear, seated and belted, I think the number of opportunities we would have to open the show, but I can tell you sincerely to our listeners, we would love to do nothing else but then to eliminate this opening segment of every one of our podcasts by not having anything to report and be able to report in any given time frame that there were not any serious apparatus accidents, particularly those where it involved a tragic injury or a line of duty death. We need to respond and be able to have our A game, as we've talked about, and bring that to the fire station and to every run all the time. And if we do that, at least the opportunities may be somewhat lessened to have us or your department or someone that you know or to have a loved one involved in one of these tragic incidents. And that brings us to what we talked about in our opening rundown is apparatus maintenance. Mercury Associates, which is a Maryland-based fleet management company, issued a report to Boston Fire Commissioner Roderick Frazier regarding the several-day overview of the Boston Fire Department apparatus maintenance and inspection program. And to take a quote from a Boston newspaper several days after the report was issued, the quote that the fire commissioner responded to was, quote, "It is an ugly, ugly report. It doesn't have much good to say about maintenance," end of quote. And to summarize, here were a couple of things that were identified. And to our listeners who may not be familiar, this report was largely prompted by the very tragic death of Lieutenant Kevin Kelly of Ladder Company 26, where that unit lost its brakes, by some description, went down a hill and actually impacted and went into a building, resulting in the injury to several other members of on the unit and the very tragic line-of-duty death of Lieutenant Kelly. And so we can just get the, as they say, let's put all the cards on the table right up front. It was pretty interesting to me, to Brother Mike and myself, that in the initial reports that came out where obviously people are trying to cover their posteriors in some cases, several people were quoted, not within the fire department ranks, but thought it was pretty foolish to send a ladder truck on an EMS call. That was what the unit was returning to quarters from, and if it hadn't been out on that EMS call, the tragic death had never happened. Well, let's think about it. Most fire departments are in the business to provide fire protection and life safety for the residents and occupants of their community. many departments tout themselves as an all-hazards agency, which means if it doesn't impact the fire, if it doesn't impact the police department, if it's not a public works matter, if you don't want to call and complain because you didn't get your mail or your mail's late, you're calling a fire department and you expect somebody to show up to your door and solve your problem. Michael, in my humble estimation, for what it's worth, if Ladder Company 26 brakes hadn't failed coming back from that EMS call, the very next run that they would have made, because the unit apparently had no brakes or very limited braking capability, the unit would have been involved in an accident at that point. So whether the unit was returning from an EMS call or returning from a run for a reported structural fire, it could have either been a working fire or food on the stove, or as I've come to know at the times I've been riding down with you and the members of FDNY Ladder Company 27, you guys seem to specialize in water leaks at 03:30 in the morning. What they were coming back from is doesn't make any difference. The fact is the brakes failed on the unit, and there was a tragic accident. Whether the unit was in a response mode or return mode, again, immaterial. Probably only by the grace of God the vehicle didn't hit any other civilian vehicle where there could have been more injuries or more fatalities. So the report outlined several recommendations, and I thought for a I believe it was a 25 or 26-page report. You can Google it up on the Internet and download it and read it. We would encourage our listeners to, if some of that stuff that's listed in that report, to me, would absolutely make the hair stand up on the back of your neck, no matter what size organization you're in. And I guess it's, to me, a pretty damning report to think about a major municipal fire department with a large fleet of engines and ladder trucks and a whole bunch of special units would be taken to task for things that I would suspect that even smaller departments in the heartland of the United States have probably done for years, that a large department like Boston simply, it wasn't that they ignored it, they didn't even do it. So it wasn't that they were half-heartedly doing some things. In some cases, they weren't doing it at all. So the report points out a couple of major recommendations. One was that there was no professional comment number one, no professional fleet manager or apparatus maintenance technicians. In the Boston Fire Department, I guess, hierarchy or organizational chart, the people that maintain the apparatus were known as the motor squad. And unfortunately, there were no dedicated, trained apparatus maintenance technician that had any degree of certification. These were typically line firefighters who had been assigned to the motor shop who had no particular training. So you can't go out and blame the people individually. Mike, I guess, you know, they were firefighters and said, here's where you're headed, and you're going to the motor squad. And part of this, there's been insinuations that this was a union item to protect fellows who were a couple years away from retirement and gave them an out when they no longer either wanted to or maybe in some cases were physically capable of fighting fires. All right. Well, we would go on with other initial findings from the Mercury Associates report. It was interesting that this was done apparently by the head or the owner of the company, so this was a single person going up there to review the Boston Fire Department maintenance practices. And one of the other findings were that there were, when time was allotted to repair or fix a particular piece of apparatus, there was no specific records or documentation regarding what was done to the vehicle and the time spent on that. So one of the questions, I guess, that came up from people that were looking at the motor squad operation of the Boston Fire Department was like, well, there were some claims that, Michael, that the group was understaffed. You know, if you show up with a 100-foot rear mount ladder truck and only two people, I think most people in a fire service would say that's an understaffed ladder truck and could identify that right away. If the rig showed up with four personnel, which is reasonably common staffing in a lot of parts of the country, people would say that's not bad staffing, but I know from FDNY standards, anything less than six or five plus the officer is unacceptable. Well, people were trying to identify what's an acceptable level of staffing of this motor squad, and since there were no particular records kept on the time spent on the repairs, it was very difficult for Mercury Associates to make an initial determination of, you know, assuming the bodies you had there, if they were trained, if they were, for the light duty vehicles, if they were ASE certified, if they were EVT certified to work on the heavy equipment. You know, do you even have enough people there, making the grand assumption that you could wave a magic wand and train them? And there really wasn't any way to determine that. Other findings were, up until a year ago, and this to me is, I can't even fathom this one. Up until a year ago, there were no pumper service tests or annual aerial ladder certification done in the Boston Fire Department, something that arguably, I guess, they have started, and looks like, sounds like they're doing maybe some of this themselves. The aerial testing is gone to an outside agency, but that wasn't being done. On a daily basis, when you showed up to the for your shift, and whoever was assigned to drive the apparatus, there was no formalized pre-inspection trip report. By all accounts, it sounds like there may have been a form out there sometime in the annals of the BFD history where they where there was a form, but apparently it was there was one term that was used in the report, and I was trying to find the description, but they said the overall practice of this, and this these words were in quotes, were loosey-goosey. Well, I guess if you're talking about an apparatus maintenance practice where the lives of the people on the apparatus themselves, before you consider anything else, is suspect, to have your program be defined by a nationally recognized consulting company as loosey-goosey doesn't make you feel very warm and fuzzy, for sure. In addition, it identified, as we discussed, there was virtually no preventative maintenance program. When things got written up on this Form 5A, as the Mercury report identified, Mike, some things got reported, some things didn't, and apparently there was a prevalence or an ethic in the fire department that you were better off keeping the vehicle there and wait until some, you know, a number of things got on this report. You had innumerable deficiencies on the rig, and then maybe you'd send it in and maybe something would be done. Something that's right up your alley, Mike, but one of the other deficiencies was noted, was that driver training was inadequate. Neither Mike or I can speak specifically to what the Boston Fire Department's training program for their drivers or what their chauffeurs or engineers, as it might maybe referred to in different parts of the country for our listeners, but they stated that the overall Boston Fire Department driver training program was weak and needed to have improvement. And the last finding, which to me this would be something that you would be if I were in charge of any function with respect to apparatus, you would, if you hadn't dug the foxhole to hide for cover, you would want to do it then, is that there was no preventative maintenance program is one aspect, and the other one is that the department, that there was a rampant amount of vehicle misuse and abuse of the apparatus. And Mike, before we launch into some of the other more specific findings, I'd like to comment on that.
Yeah, well, like we had talked about on numerous occasions, there seems to be a great disparity between volunteer firefighters and career firefighters. Although there are some career firefighters that are excellent apparatus operators and take good care of their trucks, the reality is that in most places it's a civil service job, that you take a test and you get on the job, and you are taught in varying degrees whether the training is great or whether it's non-existent, to the point of just being taught in-house by the last guy that drove the truck. You have this condition on the career side where, and it was stated in the Mercury report, where there's no buy-in, where it's just a truck, and that if you don't take care of it, somebody else will. And there's no ownership. There's no pride in ownership. A good book by Chief Rick Lasky, a department that I was just down to teach in Lewisville, Texas, which is just an awesome fire department that Chief Lasky has really molded, and great officers there and great firefighters, but that there has to be some pride and ownership in the vehicle and to take care of the vehicle. And a lot of times in the career sector, that's just lacking. It amazes me as we travel around the country how many places don't have dedicated operators, where you just go in and somebody says, okay, you're driving today. At least in some places, we have the rank of engineer, or in the case of my job in the New York City Fire Department, we have regularly seated chauffeurs, and they come, and that's what they do, and that's their job. So there tends to be more ownership in that you're going to come and drive the truck. But very difficult when you have 30 days in a month and the truck has 30 different operators each of those 30 days. There's no continuity. There's no buy-in to the fact that this million-dollar ladder truck or tower ladder needs to be owned by somebody and needs to be taken care of in-house. On the volunteer side, even though there seems to be many more operators, there seems to be this inherent department pride with apparatus, where they're, particularly in the Northeast, where they're really chromed out, as they say, or decorated with gold leaf, or and people say, well, wow, that's really extravagant. Well, maybe not. We did a test in my volunteer department. Two of the trucks had chrome wheels that were shiny, and the one truck did not. And it was amazing how much time was spent cleaning the truck with chrome wheels and washing and waxing that truck, those two trucks, and how well they looked. And then the third truck that didn't have that didn't get quite the care. And so it was determined that maybe there should be some shiny wheel covers procured for that truck. And within a year's time, the same care was taken of that truck, and it looked just as stout as the other trucks. So you say a waste of money? I don't know. If you get somebody to take care of this very expensive equipment, and you need to spend a few extra dollars to do that, particularly if you have people volunteering that are doing it for free, maybe that's not bad money necessarily spent. If you're going to get somebody to buy into the fact that there's department pride and company pride, and they feel some ownership with that particular vehicle, and then they're going to take care of it. Something that's not necessarily the same on the career side, unfortunately, where it's, in some cases, to some, it's just a job, and it's not the calling that many of us on the career side feel that it is.
But Mike, that's a good point. To quote from the report, an engine or ladder truck typically is operated by as many as 16 different firefighters. So it belongs to everybody and to nobody. And to go to your point on the dedicated driver, Mike and I have been blessed with the good fortune to travel around the country, to go talk to different departments, to instruct departments in different aspects of apparatus where they've asked for our assistance. And along with that, we obviously, in the off hours, as most firefighters do, we're going out to go visit local stations and talk to folks. If you think about, Mike, the first year or so that we got exposed to going out to the Firehouse World Show in San Diego, and we're introduced to the one captain who was the driver training officer for the San Diego Fire Department. He showed us a training material, a task book that was a self-guided instructional training program that you had to go through to get qualified on every different make and model of apparatus in that department. It was then overseen, and there was additional training run by the training division. It had to be overseen by the training officer, as well as once you got assigned to a station, and if they had a different make and model of rig, you just couldn't slide behind the wheel because you were qualified to drive, you know, the 1992 model Spartan Salisbury pumper. If that station was assigned the 99 or 2000 model Pierce, you had to get qualified on that piece of apparatus. So there was a sense of ownership. And I can tell you from the stations that Michael and I visited with then-Captain, now Battalion Chief Kevin Esther, there was, without a doubt, a large amount of pride on how those fellows took care of the apparatus. And it was evident, even to a civilian by just looking at the way the apparatus was cared for. And another example that I could cite, if in past years, while on vacation, which was in the Los Angeles area and stopped by several Los Angeles City fire stations, and you go in and introduce yourself as a firefighter from the East Coast, without exception, you were immediately ushered to the station officer who you got to introduce yourself to. And as I or Mike would be, had particular interest in the apparatus, they then turned you over to the engineer, a dedicated, trained, compensated position. And when that fellow took you around the rig, you just, I was overwhelmed by the amount of pride these fellows had in their apparatus. And whereas in other departments, you could go in and look at a rig and say, hey, how big is the booster tank? And a guy would tell you 1,500 gallons. And unfortunately, he got confused. That was actually the pump rating, but momentarily he responded with that inaccurate piece of information. In Los Angeles City, as well as in San Diego, if you asked the engineer a question on that rig, the guy wouldn't even have to pull out the book. He could recite it to you verbatim. And to me, it's a culture on the way we are supposed to take care of the apparatus that our very life and livelihood depends upon. So having said that, we're going to take a quick break here and come back in a few minutes. This is the Apparatus Architects, Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, broadcasting you on Firehouse.com.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Apparatus Architects Podcast with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. And this month's discussion, we're getting heavy into apparatus maintenance and talking about the recent Mercury Associates report that was issued on the Boston Fire Department and their maintenance program and procedures. So continuing on, Mike, the report was very, very detailed and very specific with respect to recommendations that they offered for things that should be done within 3 months, additional recommendations that should be done within 6 months, within 12 months, and then the longer-term recommendations going out to 18 months. And I would say, again, based on the seriousness of the situation there, the report was very definitive in outlining what they needed to accomplish within the next 90 days, and this was not, certainly they didn't soft pedal the issues. Recommendation number one was develop and implement vehicle inspection procedures using the manufacturer and other suitable industry guidelines, such as, and we'll talk about this at length when we wrap up from Boston, the NFPA 1911 standard for the inspection, maintenance, testing, and retirement of automotive fire apparatus in the 2007 edition. Their recommendation number two is develop and implement vehicle preventative maintenance programs for each distinct type of apparatus in the fleet using manufacturer or other specific industry guidelines. Recommendation number three was develop and implement ladder and pump testing certifications for each distinct piece of apparatus. And obviously, under each of these, to be documented. It appears throughout the report, which we didn't cover in our first segment today, that much of the recording procedures, record keeping, if you have it, was the old handwritten record and file cabinet system, that there was very little, if any of this, that was done electronically in the department, which, given the size of their fleet, the report didn't identify the total number of units in the Boston Fire Department fleet, but suffice to say it's good size, that it's a little difficult to keep track. And if your department, for example, bought four or five pumpers identical at one period of time, and it was pretty much a standard design, and then you bought, you had an off year, the next year you buy ladder trucks. See, Micah had to get that in. We bought the engines before the trucks, and then we go back and buy some more pumpers. You know, you say, well, from a record-keeping standpoint, how are the 2002 models doing versus the 2006 models? You know, we maybe had a change in a motor, or we upgraded and went from the small body pump to the big body pump. How are we doing on the pump certification testing with respect to that? Are we seeing any benefits from that? if you're keeping everything by handwritten record and throwing it in a manila folder, it's going to be a little tough to compare and contrast that as compared to having an electronic system where you could clearly identify your operating cost of the unit per mile, per run, per time frame period, and a whole bunch of other things that you could roll out. And the last thing, which would be vitally important for any department, and this gentleman, whoever they get for this, is certainly going to have his plate full, as they say. Recommendation number 4 within the next 90 days for the Boston Fire Department in the Mercury Report was hire a fleet safety coordinator who would be responsible for developing the specifications for all service requests, authorizing the non-routine maintenance and repair services to apparatus, and for performing quality control inspections for the completed apparatus once it comes back from an outside vendor, which was another part of what the report identified, that the Boston Fire Department used a lot of outside vendor resources, which is understandable given the fact that they potentially were understaffed, but without it, undertrained and lack of training. So they relied on vendors, and with Mercury Associates being a very well-known fleet management group, identified that there was no quality control process. Or let's say, for example, you tested your fire pump, it failed, and you send the test report, and you send your engine 2 down to the local vendor who does your hail pump or waterless pump or Darley pump work, and a rig comes back and it says, it's all fixed. We did a service test, and it needed new impellers, bushings, and needed a new shaft. We had to rebuild 2 valves, and $6,800 later, you're good to go. What's the quality control inspection process to make sure the repairs were actually done appropriately and without casting any questions back to the vendor, but were you getting exactly what you were paying for? So those were the 4 things that the department said should be done immediately, and then there were, again, other longer-term 6-month, 12-month, and 18-month recommendations. So suffice to say, the report was very well written, considering the limited time that the gentleman had to meet with the key players in the Boston Fire Department. And without a doubt, there's a number of things on the department's plate now, as they would say in the tennis world. Not that I know too much about it. Your turn to volley. The ball's on their side of the court now. There's quite a bit on their plate to be able to digest, to take a look to see what they need to be doing moving forward. So, Mike, the report related to, in a number of locations, the NFPA 1911 standard on apparatus maintenance and inspection. And while our listeners, you can certainly see from some of the threads that are up on firehouse.com and other websites where people want to debate the validity of NFPA standards and, you know, I don't like this in the 1901 standard and I think this is foolish. If your department does not have a qualified vehicle inspection and maintenance and testing program, you probably want to get that document in your hands as quickly as you can. I believe it's like $46 or $47 for non-members from the NFPA and a little bit cheaper if your department is a member of NFPA. And get that document and start to size up exactly what your department is doing. And it really doesn't make a difference to me whether your department has, you know, if you have your own mechanic and your own resources, that's great. Maybe to a point you control your own destiny a little bit more closely as compared to every time something breaks that you're relying upon an outside vendor. But either one can work if it's working for you and done efficiently, but more importantly, if it's done in accordance with the standard to make sure that your apparatus is ready and safe. I know, Mike, in your career, you've told me a couple of times of working with having the large fleet of apparatus that FDNY has. But I guess on any given day, if you're on the upside and your normal frontline units, the majority of them are in service, there's few that are out of service, the spare fleet is reserve and robust, and things are looking good, that you've got some, you know, some positive choices. And I know there's other times where if, you know, in other smaller departments where the reserve fleet may not be as robust or in some cases non-existent. To go back, I can remember it was even on the local news here where I lived at the Boston Fire Department shortly after the untimely death of Lieutenant Kelly, that they hired some type of local mechanical person to come in and look at rigs. I think he looked at 11 or 12 was the number, as I recall, and there was like five or six of them. He recommended they be taken out of service immediately. And because of the numbers of units that were not normally out of service, together with then the ones that were taking the hit, that there was some local TV coverage, understandably, that an engine company was running in a spare brush fire unit. But the pump didn't work on that. So basically it was a hose tender, and there was a ladder company that was operating out of a second piece that was normally assigned to the rescue company. There was a collapse unit, and they had some hand tools and, you know, some saws and so forth. But they didn't even have enough spare apparatus of any type of description to even cover the kind of unit that went out of service. And in departments that don't have spare or reserve units, I candidly think, Mike, that it sometimes reinforces that, geez, if I give up the unit I'm running on, even though there might be a problem, I know what I'm getting is either going to be worse or maybe not even going to be able to describe what you get. So would you like to comment about any personal experiences you've had there?
Yeah, my personal experience with this, Tom, goes way back to the early 80s when the strength of our spare fleet in the FDNY wasn't near what it was today. I remember going to work on a Sunday night, the brakes on the spare rig that we had just didn't seem like it was too good. And then the second run that we had, I put the maxi brake on a hill, and the maxi brake didn't hold. So I went back and called, as the apparatus operator, it's my job to call and speak with the shops. And I spoke with the shops and told them, and I was told that at that time, and again, this is many years ago, that, well, here's the deal. We have one mechanic on, you're number 16 in line, chances are that the next spare you get is probably worse than the one that you have now. So you can either baby it through the night or you can go swap and try and get another spare. So I chose to write in the book, in our journal, that, you know, I was advised this by such and such a mechanic. And early that morning at about 6:30, the mechanic finally came, and three out of the four brakes weren't making, the rotors weren't making contact with the drums. And so it was a very serious problem. One of the untold stories of the 9/11 attacks was that we lost upwards of over 80 pieces of apparatus during the 9/11 attacks, and that was on a Tuesday morning. Mechanics that had actually been retired came up in cars from Florida and started working on our fleet for several days, working until they fell asleep and then got up and worked again. Every unit in the New York City Fire Department that had lost apparatus during the attacks by that Saturday night at 9 o'clock were back in service. And much of that was due to the strength of our spare fleet and our reserve fleet. And just can't, for those out there that are in big or medium-sized cities that have the advantage of having spare and reserve fleets, the strength of that fleet, that reserve or spare fleet, really shows the strength of your fleet in its entirety. It's really, really important. Had we not had the benefit of having the spare fleet that we did at the time of the attacks, we would have been basically out of business. And so can't urge listeners out there enough that not only is it important to keep your regular fleet managed and up to speed as far as safety and preventive maintenance, but also the spare fleet as well. And there was a period of time where we were actually considering flipping rigs out, not at the 10-year mark like we do now, but even at the 8-year mark to try and strengthen the spare fleet even a little bit more, given the reliance that we had to place on it post 9/11. A big deal.
Mike, you've hit a soft spot with me. Is that, you know, in career fire departments, the size of the reserve fleet and the spare fleet, and that terminology is maybe somewhat unique from one jurisdiction to the other, because in the case of FDNY, they're a large enough department that they have ready reserve units that are staffed, that are equipped, that can be used in the times of extreme emergency by callbacks by off-duty personnel. And it's one of those things, a reserve unit, or a spare unit, whatever the local terminology is, it's not important until you need it, and then you need it, and then there's no excuse. You know, you go to the Boston situation where the number of engine companies on that one given day, when the I'm sure they were tipped off, but when the local news media, the television news media, show up at the fire station, knock on the door, and said, "Hey, we'd like to look at what you're running today," and it's a four door cab brush unit with an inoperable fire pump. That's pretty serious in a career fire department when you have personnel that are showing up to work and there's nothing for them to ride on. That's a showstopper. You know, in the volunteer service, you know, it's certainly, given today's financial considerations, it's impractical, if not just in some cases financially beyond the means, for every individual fire company. For example, if they have two engines, a ladder truck, and a rescue, to think that they're going to have a spare engine, a spare truck, or a spare rescue. But what you can think about, and if these capabilities are out there through either your local fire chiefs or county or township fire chiefs association, through your mutual aid association, however you want to do it, to look at sharing the resources beyond where your geographic boundaries are. In the great Empire State where Mike and I live, because we have villages and townships and fire districts, many people, unfortunately, have viewed those boundaries as it might as well be the Great Wall of China. So every department feels like they need to have everything to meet all of their needs. And even in the past, if you could afford to do that, it probably was not financially practical or prudent to do that. Given today's tight financial times, you might want to look at having a shared resource. So if within a certain geographic area, if a department is getting ready to replace their 1991 or 1995 pumper, it might be nice to think about, let's keep a well-maintained unit and share it as a reserve piece of equipment among several different departments on a geographic basis, rather than everybody either A, trying to maintain their own, or finding out that there's not enough resources, that nobody's got one. And again, it's the kind of thing, it's not important till you need it, and then when you need it, you really need it, and it's too late at that stage.
So, Tom, one of the things I'd like to mention now is that as we go through this economic downturn and this recession almost to the point of depression, two things that city managers and department heads want to cut, and that's maintenance and purchasing of new apparatus. You can only defer maintenance for so long, and you can only defer purchasing new apparatus. It's something actually that you really can't really defer, because it's a pay me now, pay me later kind of proposition. If a truck is broken and worn out, and it's costing hundreds of thousands of dollars to keep in service, you know, at what point are you putting good money towards bad? And it's time to cut your losses. And then again, even with a reserve fleet, at what point, do you stop operating that piece? When your first out ladder is an open cab 67 Seagrave, I mean, it's time to make a change. We saw one department like that up in Massachusetts. That was their first out ladder, was a mid-mount 67 open cab piece. You know, the truck is 50 years old. Come on, folks. It's time to buck up and get your fire department back up into the new century here. So there's, I don't believe, in my opinion, that there's any really term called deferred. I mean, if you don't pay now, you're going to pay later. And if you have to pay later, it's going to cost a heck of a lot more money. And in this case, in Boston, it actually cost one of us our lives.
Mike, to that point, it's in, there are some things on the career side where the fire chief has very limited opportunities to be able to trim or cut his budget. If you're paying for personnel services, mandated other requirements, either based on contractually or other things that are covered, it's not uncommon to find a career fire department, and irrespective of the size of the department and the numeric for the size of the budget, the fire chief really only has discretionary spending of somewhere maybe between 5 to 8% of that budget, and everything else is already been established and laid out for them. So as you alluded to, somebody says, we need to come back and we need to trim your budget by 5%. Well, you can't get it from personnel services. Can't get it from you're certainly not going to get it from what you're paying for your health insurance. You're not going to get it out of it by saying, well, we're going to cut costs here in some other areas. So the things that typically tend to get hit first are, unfortunately, two of the most important functions in the department is maintenance and training. Michael and I were in a community back within the last 12 months that had a pretty robust fleet replacement program established on a townwide basis to service a number of volunteer fire companies. And when it came budget time, the township officials thought, because we're buying all this newer apparatus, we think we can reduce the maintenance budget, and they just arbitrarily cut almost 22% out of the maintenance budget, and with the rationale being, we're buying new apparatus, so it should cost us less to maintain it. Wrong theory. You know, one of the things as departments you can do, if you're trying to looking at the requirements of NFPA 1911, and some of it may shock you as you see what they recommend for certain intervals of inspection and maintenance on the apparatus. If you don't know where they are, go on, you know, prior to the next your next meeting with your maintenance folks, go on a strategic hunt in the fire station and find out where the delivery, maintenance, and training manuals were in those large three-ring binders that were supplied when your apparatus was purchased. And look in there and find out what the manufacturer says the recommended service interval should be for that particular piece of apparatus. And if you own an aerial device, those units, without the doubt, require more maintenance. And even if your department says, we bought it used, and geez, we only use it, you know, we do 500 rigs runs a year, and it only goes out to like 80 reported structural fires, that doesn't mean you can defer maintenance on that. And typically, the maintenance cost for a properly maintained aerial device, it's going to cost more on an annual basis to maintain that than it is on your pumper. So start by looking at what the manufacturer's recommended service intervals are. If you can't find the manual or it seems confusing to you, you call the manufacturer, the guy who built the unit, ask to talk to their service department and get some information. If you maintain your apparatus within your organization with a department mechanic, hopefully that individual should have a pretty good handle as to what the service intervals are. If he's unfamiliar or you contract your services with an outside agency, maybe is the apparatus supplier that you bought it from in the dealership, it maybe is an independent company that just all they do is service work on apparatus, take the copy of what you got from the manufacturer, compare that and contrast that against 1911, go down and interview the people that are doing your work and find out and make sure that these documents are jiving. You cannot let, as Michael mentioned, your apparatus maintenance just simply be deferred and allow someone to come in and slash your budget. I know from personal experience there's a couple of large county departments here out in the east that when it came time for budget cutting, they went to the maintenance, and it got to the point that although this particular jurisdiction had a lot of second line or second due pumpers on any given day, there were so many engine units out of service, they were having to transfer stuff around because if it got to be a significant repair, for example, a pump job or a blown motor, that unit was simply got deadlined and say it's going to sit here for several months until we get into the new budget cycle because there is no money to expense for major repairs. As Michael said, it's a pay me now, pay me later. And if you haven't properly maintained your apparatus up to this stage and your maintenance budget is under scrutiny or being attacked, if you don't have the records, like was the situation in Boston, they were able to develop, based on apparently invoices, how much they spent to maintain their rigs with all the outside vendors. But short of that, if you said, for example, engine 52 in this particular make and model of unit, how much money did it cost us to keep that unit on the road last year? Those type of records without hand creating everything was virtually unavailable. And it's a little difficult then to justify a strategic and robust fleet replacement program if you can't justify how you're using your equipment now. So it becomes a whole program, and not surprisingly, in the Mercury report, within the next 90 days, that's to say, you know, you needed to institute these three things, and by the way, you need somebody to oversee and manage all of this. And no disrespect to the union brothers that were there, but it necessarily shouldn't come down to a firefighter, an officer, or a chief that's within a couple of years from retirement and really didn't have any particular expertise in fleet management. If he's there to ride out his career, having him in charge of the units that our very lives depend upon maybe wasn't, you know, the best strategic game plan to roll out. So, Mike, I know we've gotten a couple of questions from our listeners here. What do you got for us today?
All right, I got this one for you, Tom. Who insures a completed chassis? In other words, whether the chassis was built in a factory, such as a Pierce or a Seagrave or an E1 or a Supton product, and stays within that factory, if something should happen to that chassis and it catches fire, or perhaps a chassis like a Spartan or an HME or a Freightliner chassis that has to go from one place to another that has a potential of an accident before the unit is actually completed and delivered to a customer?
That's a good question, Mike, and we'll try to address this in a couple of different ways. No single pat answer here, so what we're about to say might be general guidelines, but certainly something you want to talk about with your apparatus supplier if you're in that stage. Let's suppose for the moment you are scenario number one that Mike just laid out. You're buying a new unit from somebody who builds their own custom cab and chassis, and in exchange for a reduction of the purchase price of the unit, your department is going to purchase and make a chassis payment, and that chassis is going to stay within the confines of that apparatus builder's facility while the unit's being built. It's fairly common that at least you will take title to the chassis, but you're not going to get the manufacturer's MSO until the unit's completed and it shows up at your station and you pay for it. So if you pay for the chassis in that scenario, again, this is something you want to ask the builder to say who is responsible for the coverage, but all fire apparatus builders of any size are going to have a liability policy and a garage man's insurance policy to cover the unit. So in the unlikely event, but let's suppose, for example, you know, the unit is just about done. It's sitting in a finishing bay or in a mechanical repair bay, and God forbid something happens and the unit catches fire and is destroyed, or a part of the building is destroyed. It's typically then the responsibility of the manufacturer's insurance coverage will cover any potential damage to that, and not that your community is going to be reimbursed, but they're going to build you a new unit to, you know, repair the unit to take care of that. That can be addressed by having that conversation with your local salesperson or with a representative from the manufacturer and ask them to supply you a certificate of insurance to make sure that the vehicle is covered in that respect. Scenario number two is Mike rolled out. The chassis is being built by one of the several very notable independent chassis suppliers in the United States, or it could be a commercial cabin chassis, and then it's transported over the road or sometimes piggyback to your local bodybuilder. In that case, typically, if the chassis is in transit from the chassis manufacturer to the bodybuilder, again, the chassis manufacturer's insurance typically is primary on the unit. You can certainly have the option of probably paying for a nominal increase in your premium to cover the chassis in the unlikely event that the insurance wasn't sufficient for the damage. And then once it arrives at the local bodybuilders, then it typically is the bodybuilder's insurance coverage becomes primary on the unit if, again, there was some damage that occurred while at their facility between that point until it's delivered and accepted to the fire department. So while there's no hard and fast rule here, you probably want to have that conversation with your apparatus representative, the dealership, or someone at the factory directly to cover those bases, as they say, to make sure that your financial interests are adequately protected and covered. One thing you probably don't want to do for the listeners, although some departments, this is old school, they were insistent on doing this and say, well, we did this, you know, in the 50s and 60s, is to take possession of the unit at the factory and then have your fire department personnel drive it from the factory to get to your fire station. I know for a fact there's still some departments that are insistent on that, but I'll give you a couple of practical reasons why you don't want to do that. If something, God forbid, happens to the unit, then mechanically, from point A to point B, you're now kind of stuck. It's your fire department personnel stuck out on there on the highway trying to figure out how to get the thing fixed. Going one step further, if, God forbid, you're involved in some kind of accident, let's say for example, the tire blows out, all right? Wasn't your fault. Tire blew out. You get involved where now there's incidental damage on the rig, or now maybe you've created a traffic hazard and other people's vehicles are damaged, or you're involved with a personal injury accident where you've injured yourself and injured some other private civilian. Now, because it was a fire department personnel behind that wheel, you maybe inadvertently didn't realize this, but you are now going to be predominantly responsible for any incidental or accidental damage that was incurred there, and you're largely going to be liable for that. I'll give you a very practical example of how this can appear to be pretty straightforward, becomes very convoluted. There's a department out in the eastern part of the country where the unit had been delivered to the fire department but had not yet been accepted or paid for. And it had to be transported from the fire department back to the local dealer to have some warranty work done. Not a completely unusual situation. The unit had been completely equipped, and it was equipped with Mike's favorite thing in the back, hose. While they were driving up a limited access interstate highway, the hosed 5-inch supply line became self-deployed, all right, this is prior to the NFPA standard change, and there's now 1,200 feet of 5-inch hose laid about as straight as you ever could find it up this interstate highway. And privately owned vehicles, cars, coming up the road behind the fire truck that didn't know they were running over hose, started running over the hose and damaging their vehicles. And I think it was a total of 6 or 8 vehicles, Mike, that were damaged. There was a couple that had taken out a couple tires. There were a few cars that all 4 tires were flat. There was one that he got the golden the trophy. He took out his front grille, the radiator, and all 4 of his radial tires on his, and it wasn't an inexpensive car. You know, this wasn't a Ford Pinto or Chevy Vega. This was a high-end $60,000 car. Under that scenario, who do you think ended up paying for all of that damage, to say nothing of the fact that the 1,200 feet of the department's 5-inch supply line was now irreparably harmed? When that guy got off the highway, the first thing he did was encounter the state police, who immediately impounded the fire truck. Wanted to know the guy had a CDL. You better have a CDL under those conditions, all right? And as it ended up, it was the apparatus builder's liability insurance policy that had to pay for all of that damage. In the meantime, now the fire department is without the services of the vehicle, because I believe it was the better part of about a week that the vehicle was impounded until all of this stuff was sorted out, and then finally did get back to the apparatus sales representative's facility to have the work done. So at that point, I can assure you that there is absolutely nobody happy with you, no matter how nice they like the fire truck. You've got five or six civilian vehicles that are damaged. Fortunately, again, only by the grace of God, nobody was, there were no injuries. It was just all property damage. The 1,200 feet of supply line was completely totaled out. The fire department was without the services of being able to even train and accept delivery of the unit because it was impounded, understandably, by the state police, and then they had to sort all this stuff out, and then the warranty work was done. So you can get involved in some things that seem to be extremely innocent on the upstart, and you probably want to make sure you touch all four bases before you go into the dugout and start high-fiving folks. But again, to accept units at the manufacturer's facility and then put your personnel behind the wheel is, you're taking an awful lot of risk and liability there that you probably don't want to put on yourself. So, Mike, I hope that answered the question. Kind of long-winded there. There's no just here's what you do and you'll be right and legal and proper and you won't find yourself appearing as a, in the court of law. But some things certainly to think about and ponder before you go down that road.
Well, it's just like a lot of questions that we get, Tom. There's just no one right answer. There's just no easy answer to some of these questions. I have one more for you, and because this is an engine question, I'm going to let you continue on. We are in the process of preparing specs for a new 1,500-gallon-per-minute engine. One manufacturer says the 2.5-inch piping and valves will be more than adequate. Another states that 3-inch piping and valves that are reduced to 2.5 will be better. We're a small suburban department and don't need super large flows. What are your thoughts on this subject? Thank you, District Manager from Blue Point Fire District.
All right, Michael, here's some quick thoughts there. One is that for a number of years, the NFPA, where you used to be able to put any size discharge on, this is assuming you have a side mount pump on a left side pump panel, you could put any size. You could put a 5-inch discharge on a pump panel if you want. For a good number of years, the NFPA, in good sense and safety counsel, has limited the physical size of a panel-mounted discharge on the pump panel to 2.5 inches. Beyond that, if you're plumbing a discharge to the right side panel or to the rear, really kind of depends on what kind of flow you want. You can refer back to the 1901 standard where it says for a 2.5-inch line, they'll credit you towards the pump capacity rating, 250 GPM. But understand, that 2.5-inch discharge, if it's mounted to the right side pump panel, can flow a lot more water than 250 GPM. So as a general rule of thumb, if it's a side panel discharge, a 2.5-inch discharge can easily flow upwards of 500 GPM through a single discharge. So, for example, if you were going to supply a leader line or supply a line to a sprinkler or standpipe connection, that side-mounted discharge in a 2.5-inch size can easily flow 400, 500 GPM at 150 PSI, and you can do that by just having a direct linkage valve. One of the cautions is when you use a 3-inch valve, again, right and proper in the safety mentality of the NFPA 1901 standard, you have to have a slow close device on there that, depending on the brand of valve, means it's either going to, it can still be a pull rod, but there's a device that, small little hydraulic device on top of the valve that physically restricts you from opening and closing that valve rapidly. And if it's a linkage control valve or it's a pull handle, it understandably can get a little tough to open, particularly if the pump is already, you've already got another line off and you're operating at 120, 150 PSI, opening that valve against the pressure can understandably be a little difficult and even more difficult to close. In that situation, you may want to consider using a crank-style valve. You could consider using an electric valve, but if you start using electric valves, you want to be very consistent as to and cognizant of where the valve is located. So if something were to happen on a failure standpoint, you can get in and override the valve manually by putting a box wrench on it. If the sounds like maybe the question was more related to if it's a rear body discharge. If you want to flow more than 500 GPM through a rear body discharge where you're going to put a leader line on there or maybe have like 150 feet to 250 feet of lightweight 3-inch to like a task force to a blitz fire or a mercury monitor or a ram monitor for a tailboard gun, then you might want to consider plumbing that as 3-inch piping with a 3-inch full-fold valve, and there is some advantage to that. Again, if you're running standard attack lines on there and going to run a long, like a 300-foot, you know, 3-inch and 3-quarter or a couple hundred-foot 2-inch line or a 250-foot 2.5, and you're looking to flow 250 to 300, 350 GPM, discharge plumbed and piped at 2.5 is adequate. If you're considering at some point to moving the large diameter hose to maybe changing up your hose beds, because everybody has adjustable hose bed dividers now, and at some point changing the number of attack lines, Mike and I have taught programs talking about engine and ladder company operations, and we talk about, you know, every engine ought to have the minimum, if you're operating in a rural, suburban area, you ought to have a minimum of 5 pre-connected lines, some kind of small little trash line, whatever it might be, to handle the incidental fires. 2 lines between 150 to 200 feet in long for your bread and butter fires, whatever the typical bread and butter fire is in your community. To be able to have a large capacity, minimum 250 GPM hand line with a smoothbore nozzle, be it 2-inch or 2.5, that you can use for heavy fire conditions, and then be able to have some leader line to go. If your bread and butter fire is you're getting off the rig and in 200 feet, you're through the guy's house and in the backyard into his pool, I'm sure that there are some locations in most communities that Mike and I have been to, where you have to say, what do you do when the fire is further away than your longest pre-connected line, and there's where you use the leader line in conjunction with a lightweight Y or water thief, and that might be a line, depending upon how you operate, where you may want to consider having that line possibly be plumbed as 3-inch. But to just go, and people want to know, what, how did my fire truck get so expensive, and they say, I want every discharge plumbed 3-inch, and there's 12 of them on the rig, you just, can you do it? Yeah. Will the apparatus manufacturer build it? Absolutely. They'll be happy to take your money. You have to say, well, what are you doing here? You know, it's like saying, if your parallel might be, if your family car is to get the kids around town, move them from, you know, soccer game to lacrosse game, running back and forth to church, to go to the local pharmacy and drugstore. You didn't need a 450 horsepower engine to do that. Could you put it in there and have dual tuned exhaust? Absolutely. Could you go 0 to 60 in under 5 seconds? Sure. Why'd you buy it? You got performance that you're never going to use. So I guess, Mike, in a global sense, again, no clear right or wrong answer. It sounds like that gentleman's question, in his case, he could probably go with pretty easily with 2.5. So if you're going to buy a deck gun for a master stream appliance above the pump, there's something where you want to make that 3-inch and put a slow close valve on it for sure. But for typically for pre-connected lines, 2.5-inch plumbing with a full-flow valve, and you want to look at how the piping runs, you know, and unless the thing looks like a Rube Goldberg exhaust system, more often than not, 2.5 will do it. There are times when 3-inch is appropriate, but just to put it on every discharge for the sake of saying I bought it, you can do it, but you're probably spending money that you're never going to get the full performance of the vehicle from.
Well, and of course, those folks in aerial apparatus, such as myself, really appreciate the fact that we're going to plumb a truck with some leader lines so that you can stay out of our way on the fire ground. What a novel idea.
Goes without saying, Mike, you know, I could read your mind on that. If, you know, the engines are supposed to be designed to get out of the way of the fire building to leave room for the truck. So it's just to wrap up, you know, last thing, when you see these rigs set up with, somebody says, I got a rig that's got 9 pre-connected lines. Tell me where you live so I can map quest it, because I want to come to your town to see how the rig is set up. But if your 9 pre-connected lines are on the front bumper or all in crosslays, my first question is going to be, you either better be throwing this rig in the driveway, beaching the rig, or getting the heck out of the way of the ladder truck, because the old adage is, you can stretch hose, but you can't stretch a ladder. So you want to be thinking about that, too, in terms of the setup of your apparatus. We need to work in harmony on the fire ground, and we all need to get along. So, Mike, any parting thoughts here before we wrap up for today's segment?
Well, just for all the fire department administrators out there to stay strong in these budget-conscious times as it relates to preventive maintenance, fleet maintenance, and apparatus procurement, for the safety of all.
And I'd certainly like to echo that and say if we could just simply think about operating in a safe and sane manner, gear up, sit down, and buckle up. We'd like to hope that maybe in our next podcast we'll maybe just be talking about a couple of incidents that where somebody hit us, and hopefully we'll not be talking about any more line-of-duty deaths here for the brothers and sister firefighters out there. So until the next time, this is Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects. Please stay safe, brothers and sisters out there, and we look forward to seeing you real soon. Thanks for listening.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.